This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on, is anti-immigrant hate in Suffolk County responsible for the stabbing death of Ecuadorian laborer Marcelo Lacero?
But first, the recession is certainly here. How to diminish its length and severity? A large-scale federal stimulus program is the only action that can do the job. The economy needs a shot of public investment. And if it's green, the payoff will be greatest. But what does a green stimulus look like?
And should there be an auto industry bailout? We're joined by Robert Poland, economics professor and founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, and co-author of Green Recovery, a program to create good jobs and start building a low-carbon economy.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, though the circumstances are not always so pleasurable. But I want to begin by looking at the auto industry. So while the issue is bailout, not bailout, one thing surely that I haven't heard, or maybe I have, and that is an absolute contempt for both the CEOs of General Motors and so on, and similarly, the union, who is consistently blamed for the wages and benefits that they have gotten. Should there be an auto bailout?
I do think there should be a bailout, just like we already have bailed out the big finance companies, insurance companies, AIG, Citigroup, and so forth. The ramifications of allowing the big auto companies to collapse would be devastating, especially in this environment. Look, I know that the auto companies are very poorly managed. They have been reluctant to transform themselves and build energy-efficient cars. They're way behind their competitors, Toyota, Honda, and so forth. That's all true. But now, if there is a collapse of our domestic auto companies, or even a bankruptcy and restructuring, that's going to mean hundreds of thousands of jobs lost. And this is not the time to start trying to increase efficiency by laying off people. So, yes, there has to be some support for the domestic auto industry. But in exchange, yes, just like there should be conditions for the financial market firms, which the conditions are not being set, what we need are conditions for the auto companies. The auto companies do have to raise their auto efficiency standards. Then they'll start selling more cars. If they aren't willing to do that, then the U.S. government should just buy equity in the auto companies and run them, take over management until we have a efficient and effective auto industry. But in the meantime, the last thing we need is hundreds of thousands of people losing their jobs. A big part of the lack of competitiveness with General Motors and other auto companies are their health costs, their health insurance payments that they make, and that's what diminishes their competitiveness relative to foreign automakers that do not have to carry these health costs because they're covered through national health insurance. Certainly over the next year, when we start thinking about a serious restructuring of the economy, we need to include a national health insurance program so that General Motors, Chrysler, Ford do not have to face the lack of government support for health insurance. That's one of the major factors that's making them uncompetitive. Second is that they think that they can keep selling SUVs with huge markups, and that's enough to get them over the top. There's a recent quote from, I forget which executive, auto company, said, look, there's no money to make in hybrid cars because they're experimental, there's a lot of research and development investment, and because they're smaller, you don't get as big a profit margin. Therefore, we don't make them. That is got to end, and then we have to get rid of the health insurance costs that those companies face, and that is a major factor in diminishing their competitiveness globally.
It seems as if we're going to be getting nothing out of this lame duck session of Congress. The other part was the stimulus package, and that's going down. But why do we need a stimulus package to begin with?
Right now, we are in the early stages of what looks to be the most severe recession of the U.S. and global economy since the 1930s. Now, the 1930s turned into the Depression. We had up to 25% of the workforce unemployed. It created the conditions that led to the emergence of fascism and World War II. That we obviously do not want to go back to. So that means that in this period where private capital, business, is completely uncertain, freaked out, won't invest, the government has to step in and maintain the level of spending in the economy. That's a stimulus package. It's quite simple. We have to put a floor on the level of spending. We can't let spending go down further. We can't let unemployment go up further. There has to be a stimulus. That is a given. And without that, there is nothing else that the government or anybody else can do to prevent a severe recession. We've seen that with the financial bailouts. They've been dithering now for months, and they've accomplished absolutely nothing. And the reason is that businesses are still scared to invest. Therefore, we need the public sector to invest, public investment, government spending.
Now I want to move into the idea of a green stimulus, and that is something that you have been professing for a long time. I wonder if you can explain what that would entail and how it might be implemented and how that would help end the recession?
We need to fight global warming. The question is getting there and putting in the resources and focusing a program to get us there. So a green stimulus, is the way I've outlined it, would include some short-term features and some long-term features. The short-term features would be measures to increase energy efficiency. Making more energy-efficient cars is one part of it, but the ones that I've really highlighted are ones that would create a lot of jobs. One would be investing in building retrofits to make the building stock of the U.S. more energy efficient. In that case, we know there is a lot of certainty there. You put money in, you can, for pretty low investments, you can get high returns. You can lower energy costs by a third through relatively low investments in tightening up buildings, putting in insulation, caulking, fairly simple things that are not in any way high tech. Another simple thing is simply to improve public transportation. Hire more bus drivers. Get people into public transportation. That's a big job program, and it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions and fight global warming. Those things can be done right now, immediately, and then have a big impact. Beyond that, transition to renewable energy sources. Right now, that is at largely the stage of research, development, and moving towards commercialization, and that should be subsidized. Because right now, of course, fossil fuel companies, oil, gas, coal, they don't pay for emitting greenhouse gases into the environment. So we are, in a sense, massively subsidizing the destruction of our environment through allowing them to emit greenhouse gases. What we need to do instead is subsidize renewable energy. Now, putting all these things together, it happens to have the effect, not because it's green, but because of the nature of the investments, it creates a lot of jobs. Putting money into building retrofits creates about three times or four times the number of jobs as spending in fossil fuels. That's because they're more labor intensive, it requires more people, and because the domestic content is higher. That is, creating jobs in the U.S. as opposed to in other countries. Once we start investing in the green economy, we also automatically have a jobs program. So I think that is a really major combination, a confluence of benefits that we need to exploit.
Now, Obama has come out in favor of this, but I don't think to the extent that you're proposing. What kind of numbers are you talking about, and what kind of numbers has Obama so far proposed?
Well, Obama's numbers are not realistic. Presidential campaigns are not the place to work out serious economic matters. In any case, the Obama's campaign program was not really a serious program. His program was to create 5 million jobs in 10 years through a total spending of $150 billion a year. Well, that sounds like really big numbers, but it's actually peanuts. $15 billion a year in today's economy is 0.1% of total GDP. Nothing much is going to change. I've proposed something on the order of 10 times that size, $150 billion per year, and I've tried to show how to finance it. Even that is not especially large, but right now we spend about $600 billion a year on fossil fuels. So imagine converting about 25% of that spending, shifting it into building retrofits, into public transportation, into tightening up our electrical grid system, and subsidizing renewable energy. And in 10 years, we could probably get fossil fuel consumption down by 30 or 40%. In 20 years, we can have a renewable energy economy and create more jobs in the process. I think it is a really viable program. It works in the long term. It also works very much as a stimulus program for the short term.
One of the things I do want to get your critique, you started out with a little bit about Paulson and Bernanke kind of dithering around. Is there any sense that there is any concerted effort, or is it really trial and error now when looking at the recession and certainly the current administrative posts as they are proceeding in this bailout?
It's pretty interesting because when Paulson proposed the $700 billion bailout with a three-page memo and said, look, if people don't support this, they're complete idiots and they don't understand economics. Now Paulson says, well, I guess my original idea wasn't that good to begin with, so now I'm going to try a new one. Basically, Paulson doesn't know what he's doing. The problems are difficult, and it's not clear that anybody could fully understand what they're doing. But we do know for sure that Paulson doesn't know what he's doing. I've written this a couple of times that the actual mechanics of the bailout should be done within the Federal Reserve. That's where they've traditionally done these things. Again, I'm not pro-bailout. I just don't want people suffering the consequences of a financial collapse. And the Federal Reserve should do it. It should not come out of taxpayer money. It should come out of the Federal Reserve's normal operations. And the Treasury should be focused on spending money to create jobs and to prevent jobs from getting lost and people's incomes from going down. So that really is the approach, and I don't see that Paulson has grasped that. You know, the only bright side on there is that he's only got 8 weeks to go.
And I'm sure many of our listeners would love a copy of Green Recovery, a program to create good jobs and start building a low-carbon economy. How can we get that?
All you have to do is go to Google and type in Green Recovery, and you can either get it at the website of the Center for American Progress, that was nice enough to sponsor our work, or my own institute, Political Economy Research Institute. It's out there. It's getting a lot of attention, a lot more than I had ever dreamed. I'm glad of that. At the same time, the interesting thing is, at the time that we published it, which was only 2 months ago, it seemed like a huge, audacious program. Right now, it seems like something rather puny, given this magnitude of the crisis that we're facing.
Well, we'll look at part one and then wait for part two to match the catastrophic proportions of the recession. Bob, thank you so much. And we have been speaking with Bob Pullen, who is always on the case and understands what it means to create a green recovery program. It's been a pleasure speaking with
Thanks
you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That was a segment of the wonderful Miles Davis from the album So What. Our next guest is speaking to us from Mexico City, and that is the Reverend Alan Ramirez. And we are going back to Patchogue. Jeffrey Conroy and six other teens declared that they were going to attack a Mexican, and headed to the village of Patchogue, New York, to hunt, according to their friends and the authorities. They found Marcelo Lucero, a 37-year-old immigrant from a poor village in Ecuador, who had lived in the U.S. for 16 years, worked in a dry cleaning store, sending savings home to support his mother, a cancer survivor. After the boys surrounded, taunted, and punched Mr. Lucero, the authorities say Mr. Conroy plunged a knife into his victim's chest, fatally wounding him.
While County Executive Steve Leiby, who distinguished himself for anti-immigrant legislation, would like to isolate the attack to what it is now calling white supremacists, others believe the attack is a reflection of widespread anti-Latino sentiment and racial intolerance in Suffolk County. Joining us now is the Reverend Alan Ramirez, pastor of the Brookville Reformed Church and noted immigrant advocate.
Thank you for joining us, and I know you just arrived in Mexico City, so thank you so much.
I am in Mexico City. It's a pleasure to be with you on the phone.
We have certainly looked at Suffolk County for some time now and what has been distinguished anti-immigrant activity and sentiment. There were groups like SACEM, the Quality of Life Organization, and Farming Bill. There have been firebombings out in the area, and now this terrifying murder. In your understanding and your relationship to the immigrant community out there and to social justice issues, do give us a handle, a sense of what this terrible murder actually means.
While it will be very easy, and it is very easy for us to simply think of these seven young men as those who happen to be guilty because they committed this crime directly. They did it personally. We also need to look at the bigger picture. I am willing to say that there are those, in particular, the county executive, Steve Levy, along with the legislator, Fadi, there in Suffolk County, they all have blood on their hands because for years now, they have been promoting legislation that has targeted the immigrant community. They have spoken about them as invaders, as aliens, as illegals. They have used the kind of language that demonized this community to the extent that anyone who harbors any kind of hatred in their heart saw fit to do whatever they want to this community.
Do you think there are other instances of anti-Latino violence that we're not hearing about because people are afraid to go to the police?
I have received numerous complaints, and I have now passed them on to the district attorney's office, who, by the way, is an honest individual, an individual who will do, I believe, his best to prosecute these crimes. But the point that being made right now is that, for example, the police commissioner came out and said that there were no biased crimes, that they had had one biased crime in Suffolk County this past year. You know why that happened? Because they're cooking the numbers. They're classifying hate crimes in different ways. That's number one. And number two, this community is afraid to go to the police. Thus, they are not reporting them, and they are not being classified, therefore, as hate crimes. These are the reasons. But you know what? A paper like Newsday on Long Island, which happens to be a newspaper that supports Steve Levy, will not challenge any statements like that. The police commissioner made such a statement, and it was printed as if it was gospel. None of us in the Latino community was asked to respond to such an outrageous comment.
Reverend, you mentioned to the county executive, Steve Levy. Tell us more about what these county executives and the kinds of things they've done that you feel stimulates a climate of discrimination and right reaction. And, of course, groups like SACEM and so on.
Not only has the county executive promoted laws that basically targeted the immigrant community, for example, the first thing that he wanted to do when he came into office a number of years ago was to attempt to deputize the police department so that every police officer had the same powers of immigration federal officers. And what he did was is to terrorize the community, the immigrant community, into thinking that they could no longer trust the police, that they could no longer go to the police when crimes are committed against them, because now the police could simply turn them in to immigration. So what he did was to create an image of the police as being those who were going to take each one of these immigrants and begin to deport them. Now, he also moved on to propose laws that would make it illegal for people to hire day laborers on street corners. He proposed laws and backed laws that would make it illegal for people who are not related to one another could not live in the same household. Now, you see, and it's interesting that these all applied to Latino immigrants. For example, out in Suffolk County, there is the great place you call Fire Island in the Hamptons, where Upper West Side Wall Street young men rent group homes. But I didn't see any of those group homes being targeted and being closed up because they were people who were not related to each other, and yet they were living together. So this is what I mean by creating an environment of fear and terrorizing this group of people simply because of who they were. Because of that, we had some neo-Nazis who came in, picked up a couple of day laborers, took them to an abandoned work site, and beat them almost to death. They almost killed one of them. Then a bunch of young men on the 4th of July, the most American of all holidays, on the 4th of July, they went in and they firebombed the house of a Mexican family. And again, on that occasion, they said they just wanted to go get some Mexican. Now, people, kids, they do what they hear adults and our leaders telling us it's okay. And he has been giving a green light to anyone who harbors resentment against immigrants to go out and do whatever they want against them. He is partly responsible. He directly didn't plunge that knife into Marcelo, but he indirectly encouraged this by creating this environment and climate of hatred. That's what this is about. And we, as a Latino community, who also happens to be a very faithful people, a very religious people, we are willing to forgive. Believe me, we are a very forgiving people. But forgiveness can only come when there is an acceptance of responsibility and there is a willingness to repent on his part for the way he may have contributed to this. Without repentance, there can never be forgiveness.
And what about somebody like Peter King, who has been on the national stage vociferously tilting the discussion around immigration in the most virulent, angry, anti-immigrant way?
He and Mr. Levy are partners in this. They work together. One works it at the local level, the other one at the national level. And the question is, will there be a voice of reason in this argument? Will there be someone who says, we are ultimately a nation that has always welcomed people from other places of the world? We keep saying that these recent wave of immigrants are illegal. Well, you know what? Everyone, the majority of people came to this country illegally. They came to Ellis Island and they were just processed. They were allowed to come in and they were given time to then get their papers in order. We no longer have that ability, the ability to do that. We no longer give people that opportunity. And so even though our nation continues to produce jobs at the entry level, we do not give the visas for them or the ability for them to come in and then get their papers in order so that they can be here legally. So that is as much a fault of the government as it is of the worker. We are now living in a global economy. And that global economy produces jobs. And if there are workers, wherever they are in the third world, they and those jobs are going to come together. It is unfair for a capitalist system, for example, to allow the capitalist to pick up his factory that he built in the United States and build it in Nicaragua or another third world country because he can make his product cheaper, and it's unfair not to allow the worker to move himself to where he can get a better wage for his labor. That would be fair when it comes to capitalism, but this is an unfair way of working out this capitalist system. They are not allowed to have visas to come to the United States. Who is? Only the economic elite of other countries. I have friends here in Mexico City. They have 10-year visas. They can go in and out. Why? Because they're the economic elite. But the poor, the one who struggles, the poorest, the most vulnerable among us, the one who's trying to better his life, the one who truly has the spirit of what America is about, the one who is willing to sacrifice himself and work hard, he is not given the same opportunities.
Reverend, in the face of this murder of Marcelo Lucero, what should Governor Patterson do and what should be done to address this virulent hate crime, this lynching?
I would hope number one, that Governor Patterson, and I have to begin by commending Governor Patterson. He was the only public official who called me at 6:30 in the morning on Monday morning after this tragic incident. I cannot say the same about any other public official. And I can tell you that if this would have happened to an African American, it would have happened to a member of the Jewish community, if someone in those communities would have suffered something similar, all of these public officials would have been tripping over each other to reach the microphones to denounce this. But in this case, it's just an immigrant. It's just a Latino. It's just a day laborer. And therefore, I do commend Governor Patterson for being sensitive enough to say this is outrageous and saying it immediately and communicating it to us. Now, I believe that a responsible Democratic Party ought to begin to address Mr. Levy's position within that party. Does Mr. Levy, who should take some responsibility for the climate that has been created, for making Suffolk County the epicenter of hatred in the United States toward Latino immigrants, they must ask themselves the question, does this individual represent the Democratic Party, its ideals, its principles, its philosophies? If they believe that he does, then they should, I guess, let things go on as they are. But if not, I think that they have a moral and an ethical obligation to do something, to remove him from office, to force him to resign, because he does not represent the community. And that would be a signal, not only to the Latino community, but to everyone in our county and in this country, that the Democratic Party stands for justice and stands for what is ethical, for what is moral, and for what is right.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but we certainly won't leave the issue in general or the issue specifically of the murder of Marcelo Lucero. And again, Reverend Ramirez, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Buildingbridgesradio.org.